good evening and welcome to The Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan and joining me in studio tonight I have Alan Farrell, Fine Gael TD for Dublin Fine Gael, Gary Gannon, Social Democrats TD for Dublin Central, Breed Smith, People Before Profit TD for Dublin South Central, Éan O'Riordan, Labour TD for Dublin Bay North and Harry McGee, Political Correspondent with The Irish Times. Now we want to hear from you, so do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte, hashtag RTELD. Well, it's here. The first case of COVID-19 has been identified in Northern Ireland and it's we now know that that patient travelled home from Northern Italy through Dublin Airport. I'm joined on the line now by Dr. Kevin Keller, Head of Public Health with the HSE. Dr. Keller, thanks for joining us. Can you tell us what we know about this patient this evening?
Well, I'm not going to give any details about the individual concerned because, as our colleagues in the North have said, that's inappropriate. All I can tell you is that we've been contacted by our colleagues in the North about a person, and we have got information from them, and we are working on their behalf to look at any contacts that may have been made as a consequence of that person's transfer through Ireland, and that's what we're doing at the moment.
Can we say when
Sorry,
this?
Just to say, this is what we're doing is following well set out protocols that have been in place for many, many years, and we've used them a lot of times over the years because we use them when there are other possible infections on airplanes, and we've used these well 10, 20, 30 times over the years. And they work extremely well, and so people know exactly what to do, and so it's worked extremely smoothly.
I see the reports this evening, Dr. Keller, is that that it will be people who were sitting two rows before and two rows behind this patient, this person, who will be contacted in relation to this. Is that correct?
Well, what will happen is that we will contact directly everybody who is deemed a close contact. What you've described is generally speaking what happens, yes. But also anybody on the plane will also be contacted by email or letter, whichever is the way that we can do it, just to give them more general information as well.
Okay, so everybody on that plane will be alerted to this. Are we going to tell people when that plane arrived in Dublin Airport?
Well, I don't think there's any need for that because everybody who was involved in the episode will be contacted.
And in relation to that person's transport then from Dublin Airport to Belfast, I see the Independent is reporting this evening that they travelled to Belfast by train. Can we confirm that?
Well, we are involved with Northern Ireland in making sure that we follow through their path from London here in Ireland up to Belfast, and we're doing that with the Northern Ireland authorities, and we're making sure that that we contact anybody who would be deemed a contact as a consequence.
But if this person did travel by public transport, will you know who was on that bus or that train?
We have methods of doing so. If they travelled by public transport, we can do that, yes.
But do we know that is what happened, that they were on public transport?
I think it's important to say that I'm not going to give away anything that would identify the person and or needs. We have got sufficient information such that we can contact the people who would be involved, be they travelled by private or public transport. And that's what we're doing.
Can I just put it to you, though, and I appreciate that there is issues of privacy and issues of not, you know, panicking the public in relation to this. But surely, as it stands, anybody who flew in from Northern Italy in the last number of days will now be worried. And certainly anybody who took public transport from Belfast to Dublin. Would it not be better to just say it was at this time and this train or this bus?
Everybody who was on the flight will have been contacted by phone or email this evening. If we don't have an email address for people, they will receive a communication by whatever way it is possible to do, considering what information we have on them. So everybody will be contacted.
That's in relation to the flight, and I understand.
Yes,
but
then,
you have a flight manifest or a passenger manifest.
Yes,
but you won't have that for everybody who was on a train, if that was indeed the method of transport to Belfast.
If we have an ability to know what happened, and that's been followed up by both ourselves and the people in the North, And I can assure you, we do know what's happened, and we are contacting anybody who was involved in that process.
So there is absolutely no concern that there is any stage of this journey where there may have people who came into close contact with this person who will not be contactable. That's what you're telling us this evening.
We will make every possible attempt to contact people, and we've been doing that this evening already. So the significant numbers of people have already been contacted, and the rest will be contacted. The people in close contact, which is a technical phrase, will be contacted by phone. Other people will receive an email stroke letter, and that's how we've done it.
Okay, but as I say, you're confident that you have details for everyone who was in close contact?
Yes, we've got as much information as is as possible to have, and we're making sure that we're trying to contact everybody. Now, clearly, some of that may extend into tomorrow just because people may not be available or have their phones or other things switched off, but that's what we're seeking to do.
Okay, now in relation to the overall situation then, I saw Tony Holohan this evening saying that this doesn't change the general advice that has been given to the public already in relation to where we're at and what you should do if you...
No, absolutely not. Ireland's position is in the same as it was 12 hours ago. We are in a process of trying to contain the disease. This is part of our attempts to contain the disease, so we can make sure that we can reduce any risk of it being transmitted on the island. That's what we're seeking to do. As we were saying at the HSE press conference today, an important part of this is trying to delay any such cases coming into Ireland such that we can have more time to prepare for when there is a significant problem, if that turns out to be the case. So that's one of the key parts of this, is trying to stop it coming into the country at all possible, but even if we can't do that, is to delay it such that we have more time to prepare ourselves for whatever might eventually happen as a consequence.
And in relation to that advice as well to people who may have been in one of these affected zones and may have some symptoms and are waiting for test results, this advice to self-isolate in the home, can you just explain to people how meticulous would you need to be if you find yourself in this position? Like, can you run out to get a pint of milk if you're...
Well, we would prefer that you didn't. And on the whole, we are trying to make sure if we are getting people to self-isolate at home, that they wouldn't have to do that because there'd be somebody else with them who could do that for them as a consequence. We would certainly not, if somebody was living totally alone, we would not seek to have them self-isolated. We'd actually try to keep them in hospital such that they didn't have to, or in another facility, they didn't have to go out into to do things for themselves. Now, on the whole, at the moment, this is only for a period of something like 24, 30 hours whilst we await the result. And as you know, since at the moment there is no case in the Republic of Ireland, therefore, you know, nobody has had to ever wait more than that period of time to be told they're all right and they don't need to self-isolate anymore.
And we are confident, are we, that should there be more cases or more suspected cases, that we have adequate testing kits available, that we have adequate ability to test large numbers?
Yes, the laboratory has been very well done. It's made major efforts, and it can up its rate quite significantly if needs be, and well above any level we're presently testing.
And in relation to the level of preparedness, we saw there Dr. Michael Dwyer, who is head of an anaesthesia and critical care in St. Vincent's Hospital. He raised concerns today that if there are cases and more than a scattering of cases, that the ICUs are already running at overcapacity. So surely that is a matter of serious concern, or should be a matter of serious concern.
As you heard the Chief Executive Officer of the HSE say today, that is part of what we're trying to do. That's why we're trying to do what I'm mainly responsible for, is this containment process, such that the HSE can look at how it can prepare itself to cope with these demands in the not-so-distant future, and that's what we're trying to do. Yes, it will always be difficult. Every healthcare system in the world will have difficulty to cope with what we're talking about. But that's what we're trying to do. We are looking at where we can increase capacity, both by extra space or extra ventilators and staff. That's what's happening at the moment. And what I'm trying to do is give the system time such that by the time that we're no longer able to contain it, if that comes to that point, we have had much more time to plan and prepare and create that capacity.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Thank you for joining us with that. That's Dr. Kevin Kelleher there, who's head of public health with the HSC. Breed Smith, we're not hearing an awful lot of detail about this particular patient. It doesn't sound like we are going to hear much more detail.
Well, whatever about the detail about the particular patient, there's no doubt that the rate, the incremental rate at which this virus is spreading globally is quite worrying. And I think the biggest worry for us, which you're not getting the answers from Dr. Holohan or the previous speaker, is the capacity of our health service to cope with any increase in any other epidemics or contagious illnesses. Because already, I mean, don't have to tell the Irish public the state of our health service, but it is a fact that per head of the population, we've got less than half of the emergency beds that are required when you look at the European average. And then we've got less than half of the ICU consultants that are needed. So we're already, some of our hospitals are operating at 110% capacity, which is in itself is a very dangerous position for a health service to be in, because that allows for the spread of more diseases. It doesn't give time for wards or beds to clear out, for the air to clear anything else. So apart from the crisis of our of the patients lying on trolleys throughout our hospitals, apart from the crisis in our ICU units, we are not going to be able to cope with an epidemic like this. And that's what they're not saying. They're not owning up to say, we're in trouble, lads. That, you know, and he's saying, give me time, I'll prepare. Give me time, we'll prepare. Could they have said that in the last 10 years about time to prepare for, to get rid of the trolley crisis, to give us at least a fraction of the 2,500 beds that were promised under Sláinte Care 7 years ago? They've done none of that. So why should we have any confidence in them? Whatever about the individual, how he or she travelled and how we might be contaminated, this will repeat itself. There will be more incidents, because when you look at the rate, as I say, that has travelled throughout Europe and beyond, it is bound to come to the Republic, and we're not ready for it, and we can't be.
Alan?
Well, just to correct Breed there, Sláinte Care is 2 years old, but the not seven, and there are significant numbers of extra beds.
Sorry, I should have said 2017, that's more than 2 years.
Yeah, it's just over 2 years. The bottom line here is the containment is critical in making sure that we don't have a huge number of cases appearing, and making sure that individuals follow the advice that has been provided by the HSC. And if people are symptomatic, which is cough or shortness of breath or breathing difficulties or even a fever, to contact their GP, not to leave their own home, to contact their GP, and in turn to contact the HSC. The protocols are clear, and has been said by Dr. Holohan, and indeed I think by Dr. Kelleher as well. You know, the HSC have been working on this since January, and Breed is quite right that it has been exponential in terms of the number of cases that are being discovered globally. It's on every continent bar Antarctica, and I have no doubt that it will continue. The incubation period is problematic because individuals may not be aware that they might potentially have been exposed to this particular virus, and that may not manifest. I believe it's 14 days. So therefore, there are issues in terms of you know, how this patient in Northern Ireland got to Northern Ireland from Dublin Airport. I have absolute faith in the HSC and the authorities in terms of identifying the individuals on the flight.
On the flight, yeah, But
whether it was a bus, Katie, yeah, or whether it was a train, or whether it was a car, I mean, clearly the HSC, or sorry, the authorities in Northern Ireland are clearly working with the HSC here to ensure that, firstly, there isn't panic, but secondly, and I think most importantly, to ensure that the individuals who might have been in close proximity to this patient are identified and contacted. And that is something that you heard in great detail there, has taken place and is taking place. And as I said, I have every faith in their ability to go through the process. You said it yourself in relation to the flight. There is a flight manifest there. The individuals in question have already been contacted. And the 2 metre rule, or two row, I suppose that would probably be on an aircraft have already been contacted directly.
Well, I just say we're getting a lot of texts in and on the back of that interview with Dr. Kelleher there. What flight, what day? It's critical information. My daughter was through Dublin Airport recently. Harry, are you surprised that the level of information that they're sharing with us in relation to this?
I'm flabbergasted. I think they should be sharing all information. They should be telling us, you know, I mean, okay, maybe they're trying to avert any sense of mass panic. There is a bit of the HGL's War of the Worlds thing. You can see every report in every news organisation in the world is dominated by coronavirus at the moment. But it is a serious problem and it's spreading so quickly.
And I think there's nothing sure to spread panic than the feeling that you're not being told something.
An information vacuum. Just speculation and rumour and supposition fills that information vacuum. And it's better when they just say, if the person was on this particular flight, on that particular train, and all the people have been alerted.
And then everybody else on every other flight or train can relax and...
But it has to be said that this whole debate, and in fairness to everybody, I'm sure that they agree that this whole debate should be led by the medical professionals involved. And if they... And in fairness to them, I'm not a medical professional, but in fairness to them, if they believe that this is the appropriate course of action, if they're following the WHO guidelines, if they're following the European Centre for Disease Control... and other international bodies, that's the process that they must go through.
But are medics automatically experts in, you know, handling a public...
Well, in disease control, they are.
In disease control, but handling the public information.
Everybody wants to play their part here and nobody wants to play politics with a situation like this. Rumours are already flying around the place about a positive case in Dublin. I think it's probably inevitable that we will have a positive case in the Republic, and it's how we deal with that situation. So there is a balance to be struck between information and causing alarm. But I would agree with Harry. I don't think there can be enough information. I think everybody in the country needs to know exactly how they can react to a situation when inevitably it probably will come to light that we do have a case in the Republic. I would make one small suggestion. I would say, I thought there was a small misstep over the rugby international when the recommendation was made by the minister, and then 24 hours later there was a meeting with the IRFU over the upcoming Ireland Italy game. I just felt that gap was probably not helpful. So,
Who are you blaming for that? Do you think they should have been consulted before?
I think there should have been maybe a better management of that situation where both announcements could be made.
From the minister's point of view.
I think it's a small point. I think we're at the beginning of this situation. But I think when you're dealing with information and public alarm, that you have to say these things in concert. So for a minister to come out and say, look, it is my recommendation that this doesn't go ahead. And then for 24 hours later for the finality of the decision to be made, look, it's the beginning of a process. We're not trying to, as I say, score political points. But information is key in this scenario. Everybody wants to play their part. But the point that Breed has made is quite right, is an appropriate one as well. It is going to shine a light on the capacity of the Irish health system to deal with an issue such as this. And I would share her concerns.
Yeah, we just got another text in here. Kevin Keller sounds as convincing as Mr. Neary when he said the banks were well capitalised. While you can trace plane passengers, you can't trace bus or train passengers who pay cash. The HSE have no credibility on this. Gary.
Every medical professional that we've heard from so far, and when you go onto the websites of the World Health Organization, they're all telling us that we need to stop the panic in relation to this particular issue. Our role, I think, as public representatives can be as arbiters or providers of the information that allays people's fear. Already on WhatsApp this evening, there's rumours flying around. They're talking about a potential, and they are just rumours talking about potential hotels being closed down at the minute. In order to allay panic, we need to be given information. And information is absolutely key here. And information is going to be essential in terms of decisions that were made in relation to suspending the rugby match. This also might become an issue in relation to St. Patrick's Day. All of these things have the potential to increase public anxiety around this. And it's the role of public representatives to allay those fears. We need as much information as possible.
If we want to play our part.
We do, absolutely.
Okay, I've got Susan Mitchell on the line. Susan, of course, deputy editor of the Business Post and also that newspaper's health editor. Susan, were you listening to Dr. Kelleher there?
I was, yes, I was, Katie.
The reaction we're getting in our text line here and just talking to the panel is they were very surprised that there isn't more information forthcoming about the basic travel arrangements of this particular patient.
Yeah, so look, I heard Aon there and I'd agree with him that public health officials, I suppose, are in a difficult position in that they're trying to, on the one hand, communicate all of the relevant facts to the public, and on the other hand, trying to allay any panic or ensure that panic doesn't set in. I'd need to talk to more public health doctors myself to figure out why the HSE and indeed the Department of Health in the North are not releasing details such as the flight number and indeed the mode of transport, because as one of the texters who just texted in said there, you know, it's very difficult to trace people who are on buses and paid cash, etc. And I think that at the moment there's probably a lot of people out there who took flights home and are wondering, well, was that my flight? So I think we would, you know, I think it would be beneficial, or at least for it would be good if the health service explained why it isn't giving that information to us. But I think there's one thing, you know, we're all there's been a lot of talk about the health service and the preparedness of the health service. And I wrote pretty extensively about intensive care capacity and the fact that we don't actually have any surge capacity. In other words, any excess capacity if there is a big crisis. And that's certainly true. But there is no health service in the world that is actually equipped to deal with a massive pandemic if that actually happens. At the moment, we have one case that we know of in the north, and that's it. If there are a number of clusters throughout Ireland, and this is limited to a number of clusters, that is probably pretty manageable. The problem is that if that changes to hundreds of cases, you know, where it's difficult to actually trace initial contacts, and when the virus begins to spread locally, that actually makes it really, really problematic when there's community transmission and significant human-to-human transmission that they can't trace. And that's where we're really going to struggle here, because not only do we have a shortage of ICU beds, we also have a shortage of isolation facilities. We don't have much. There's patients who get very sick from this, from coronavirus, and only about 5% of patients get severely acutely ill from this. 80%, you know, get cold-like symptoms and recover quite well. But those who become severely ill need mechanical ventilation and the use of this technology called ECMO, which effectively adds oxygen to a patient's blood and acts like their lungs. Only 2 patients can be treated at any one time with that in this country at the moment. That's another thing that we're likely to run into trouble with, again, if we have a major outbreak.
People are comparing this with the flu, but that's not a good comparison, is it?
No, it's not, because, well there's two things really. Firstly, this appears from the initial data, and again, it's evolving all the time. So the data, I'm constantly having to change things almost on a daily basis. But at the moment, the data that we have on coronavirus, there was a massive study done in China of about 45,000 patients, and it suggests that the fatality rate is in the order of 2%. I should say that fatality rate is pretty much, there have been no deaths of kids under 9 virtually. Hardly any young people die from this disease, but it is there is a high fatality rate, unfortunately, for older people and people with underlying chronic diseases. By comparison, the fatality rate for the flu is in the order of 0.1%. So this is much more fatal, and the initial data also suggests that it's much more transmissible, i.e., you know, one person is likely to infect a lot more people with coronavirus than your typical person with flu.
And we're getting a lot of texts in, particularly now because of this case having come through Dublin Airport. You know, why aren't we stopping flights coming in from affected regions? Why aren't we taking people's temperature coming through the airport? But there's a good reason why we're not doing this, isn't there?
Yeah, so it's interesting because I asked that question actually today at the HSE's press conference, and Dr. Kevin Keller, who you obviously just had on there, said that they're following the World Health Organization's advice, which is that there is no need to stop people travelling or people returning from Italy, etc. Now, other countries have taken a different approach. The UK has adopted much more stringent measures, for example, than we have. So people who've returned from countries with a high number of cases, such as Iran, Korea, and China, are asking, they're asking those people to self-isolate. We're not doing that. And again, they're saying that this is based on the advice of the World Health Organization and the European Centre for Disease Control. But what I think is interesting is that, you know, the vast bulk of global health experts in infectious diseases say that you know, historically, travel bans and that type of thing haven't actually been very successful because they've diverted attention to issues that ultimately failed. However, that said, they do tend to delay the arrival of cases in different countries, and that gives health services and people trying to manage these things a bit more time to prepare. And interestingly, in China, obviously cases in China are beginning to fall quite significantly, or they certainly have over the past couple of days or week. And that is forcing people to reconsider a little bit what they think of these travel bans, because it would appear that the measures adopted in China, which were extremely severe and huge, the lockdown of multiple cities, travel bans, nobody allowed to leave Wuhan, etc., do appear to have had been successful in terms of trying to contain, albeit a little bit belated, the cases within China.
Okay, although I wonder how manageable those kind of measures would be in a society that's not as controlled as the Chinese society is.
That's a very good point, because can you imagine that we were told that Belfast was going into a lockdown tomorrow, nobody was allowed in or out, and, you know, what happened in China also had a lot of, you know, not only did it impact on obviously individual rights and freedoms, but a lot of people with existing illnesses and diseases weren't able to get treatment there. So there were, you know, they were very severe measures, but from a larger public perspective, the initial evidence or the initial data would suggest that actually it was effective in reducing the spread of the disease in China ultimately.
Okay, Susan, I'll let you go. Thank you for that. No doubt we will be speaking about this again, because it is, as you say, a very fast evolving story. I'm just looking at that we're getting a huge, huge amount of texts. A lot of people worried, very worried. And then people saying, for goodness sake, the panic is starting already in this day and age. Almost nobody pays cash for train tickets, practically all online bookings. Seems like terms like massive pandemic will simply fuel panic. Let's deal with the reality here and now. Another one, Katie, can you ask how many consultants, doctors, nurses, hospital staff return to work after their skiing break in Italy this week? Do we even know? Just in relation to what's coming up and what this might affect actually now, because now that we actually do have a case, I'm thinking about your big march, Breed, the March for Change, have to be reviewed.
Well, then they'll have to review the running of the Lewis, the running of the Dart. I mean, by comparison, there's tens of thousands of, you know, hundreds of thousands of more people travel by rail and by Lewis and buses every day than will be on that march. Oh, that were not the case, that we'd have more than hundreds of thousands on the march, I'd be delighted. But honestly, if they consider banning the march, they're going to have to justify it very strongly with the consideration of stopping the Lewis running or the Dart running, because that's just irresponsible.
Oh, well, I don't think that would be the case, Breed. But I mean, look, the advice...
Stopping the march or stopping the Lewis?
Either. Look, the advice from the World Health Organization and others is... in terms of ban, as Susan said, is that you know, it would not necessarily be effective. There are many ways of getting from an affected region to Dublin or to anywhere in this country.
If you ban
flights from the affected region in Italy, well, what's to say they might go through Paris or London or anywhere else, and then.
I'm not talking about banning flights. I'm talking about mass gatherings and
referring back though to that point that, you know, it isn't necessarily effective because there are other means of getting to places that we all know. I mean, in terms of individuals that potentially, for instance, might be travelling to Ireland for St. Patrick's Day, for instance, if these individuals are coming from areas where there might have been an outbreak, well then, you know, there has to be a question asked. And I think those individuals would have to ask themselves whether it's appropriate for them to travel under the circumstances they might find themselves in.
Yeah, but we're relying an awful lot on personal responsibility here.
Well, true, but I mean...
People doing the right thing.
I think, we you know, it has been referenced that this isn't the flu, it's not like the flu, but it's about 20 times more virulent than the flu, as has been identified by Susan and others. And the morbidity rate is about 2%. And that number is actually falling, and that's been clarified already. But the number of cases, for instance, in the four regions of Italy has gone from, I think, 200 in the first 2 days to about 600, I believe, in 3 or 4 days. So, you know, clearly this is quite virulent and is something that we have to watch very, very carefully.
I just get the sense we're talking a little bit in a vacuum. Yeah. I feel a little bit disempowered by what's happening. We want to play our part as public representatives to be part of the collective effort to contain or to give information. At this point in time, I just would be a little bit uncomfortable as the space in which we're in.
Well, that's certainly the tone of the vast majority of
and that's not an attempt to be alarmist. Yeah. It's just an attempt to be
just for comparison purposes. When Susan was talking there, she was talking about the different approach that's been taken in the UK and asking people to self isolate. And to me, that might seem like a sensible. I mean, if somebody's been in those affected areas of northern Italy, I mean, the case that's been identified in Denmark, that was somebody who was returning from skiing in northern Italy. And a lot of the cases that emerged in Tenerife also emerged from northern Italy. So there is a case that some people who have been in affected regions, and as Alan was saying, the disease, the virus has spread very quickly there, from 200 up to 584 in the course of 2 days. So then you look at different measures, like, for example, in Japan, the Prime Minister has ordered that all primary schools be closed down. Now, that might be a little bit extreme. And Susan also referred to the measures that were taken by the Chinese authorities in terms of isolating entire cities, putting people into quarantine, cutting all public transport.
And building two huge hospitals.
In the space of a week, yeah. So not possible here. But yeah. I mean, the only way that it might be stopped is to have an outright travel ban, but that would be completely extreme. So you have to put in measures that are sensible, but are also proportionate and also are common sense.
Okay. People are going to feel insecure. They want to feel secure.
Mm. Yeah.
And the most important that comes from governmental leadership and political leadership.
I agree. And I think the most important point, and I actually agree with Anne, the most important point, though, is that people follow the advice of the HSE.
OK, I think we can all agree on that one. Let's move on, because politics is still happening. Eoin, how's your campaign going?
Very well, yeah. I'm just back from Kilkenny, where I met Labour members in Kilkenny, and great support from our general election candidate there, Dennis Hines, who's an excellent SIP2 official and our general election candidate. So huge support from...
The hustings are starting next week,
next Monday in Cork. So I'll be in Cork on Saturday, and we have hustings in Cork on Monday evening and then in Dublin on Thursday evening. And there's 5 hustings over the course of the next few weeks. And the ballot papers will be issued to members on the 20th of March.
And what is the difference between you? What's the difference in your pitch and Alan Kelly's pitch?
Well, look, I have a very realistic view of where the Labour Party is. Our support base amongst young people is between 18 and 24 is 2%. I think we have a proud past, but our proud past does not offer us any, doesn't mean that we have as proud a future unless we begin to change things as to how we connect with people, how people view us. I think we have a relationship with the Irish people which has been damaged. If you have a relationship with anybody, you need to repair that relationship. If we continue with that support base, particularly amongst young people, then we're going to be in a very difficult space. Yeah, so what I'm trying to say, Katie, if I might.
No, I'm just saying the difference, because that sounds quite similar to what I've heard Alan Kelly saying as well.
What we are trying to say is that the Labour Party needs to, I think, get above the noise of Leinster House. I think people are turned off by political parties squabbling with each other. What we want to return to is to be a campaigning, issue-based party, and you can campaign and you can deliver and you can win on issues, be it inside a government or outside a government. And one of the things I am determined to promote and to talk about is the fact that 25% of Irish workers are in the low pay bracket. And that's an OECD statistic. We're second only to America in the number of proportion of Irish workers which are in low pay. And what we need to do is to think about the reason as to why the Labour Party was founded. And the reason for the Labour Party actually was to ensure that workers had representation, and currently in Irish law, employers effectively have a veto.
We'll give you more time to set out your big platform. But what are you saying to people? Pick you rather than Alan Kelly. What's different
analysis of where politics is now.
Does Alan Kelly not have that?
Well, you see, I don't think it's fair. And I don't think it's the way that politics should be run, where, you know, media commentators like yourself demand of me to effectively criticise another party.
I'm asking for the difference.
I can only put out my own stall. What I'm saying is that I have an analysis of where the Labour Party has been and where the Labour Party needs to go. I'm looking, hold on a second, Katie, you've asked me the question and then you're asking me to hurry up.
I'll give you another opportunity, and hopefully we'll have you in here,
support,
and hopefully with Alan Kelly to argue your case.
I would absolutely welcome that. But I would say this much. Look, There is a need for us, obviously, to rebuild. There's a need for a Labour Party in Ireland.
And is that definitely outside of government this time? Would anything persuade you that actually in the national interest you could support any of the arrangements being discussed?
We did that before in 2011.
Okay, that's a no then.
Well, I believe we don't have a mandate to go into government. And that doesn't mean, by the way, that we can't support an individual governmental measure on issues such as education or childcare or whatever. But I don't believe our space is in government in the short term, no.
Okay, well, let's talk about people who are talking to each other. Harry, what happened today? Who was talking to who today?
Well, somebody moved the vehicle. They pushed it maybe 1 inch. And there's still perhaps another marathon-like distance to go. So the Greens were talking to Fianna Fáil today for the second day. They did this exercise with Sinn Féin earlier this week, and I think they're going to do the same exercise with Fine Gael if Fine Gael decides that it's going to go into government rather than going into opposition, or that is minded to go into government. And the big thing that came out of it today there was a couple of things that came out of it today where Fianna Fáil seems to have done a U-turn on its U-turn on rent freeze. Which is extraordinary.
So it's going to meet itself on the way back on this one.
Yeah, and that was, I mean, from a purely campaign strategy point of view, that was a terrible mistake by it during the campaign because it had committed itself to a rent freeze and then it announced in the middle of the campaign that it was not going to go ahead with the rent freeze. And that was a classic flip-flop and it was called out on it and suffered for it. And now it seems to be kind of flip-flopping on the flip-flop, even though Darragh O'Brien is saying that it's still retaining its position. But it seems that Fianna Fáil just doesn't know how to make up its mind in relation to this issue. The other thing that was interesting today, Eamon Ryan did a number of interviews today and he seemed to be querying the Sinn Féin figures and whether Sinn Féin was capable of financing its promises based on the figures it projected in its manifesto.
In terms of the taxes that would have to be raised.
So maybe was this Eamon Ryan kind of signalling that maybe he's
veering
edging a little bit towards Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, or is it Eamon Ryan kind of testing Sinn Féin more to see if it's going to come up with more credible figures from his perspective?
Okay, Alan Farrell, when are you going to stop sulking and come out and play ball with everybody else?
Well, you know, Katie, I respect the right of journalists to ask that question, but I would for a moment look back at the past number of years and recall the opposition parties, all of them, and media commentators calling out on issues that might have arisen over the previous years. And Gary, you can cough or whatever you want to do.
Well, Gary has his own questions to answer in relation to not playing ball.
But I think we have to bear in mind that Fine Gael lost the election. We have gone from 76 seats.
I don't think I've ever heard a political party in all my years covering politics telling me how big losers they are.
I'm still going to make my point, and my point is that 9 years ago we had 76 seats. So four years ago we'd 50.
That was Harry
Now we're 35. And the point is that, you know, we did our best with a very, very difficult set of circumstances over a long number of years.
Alan, with the greatest respect, we know all of this.
And the position is there are 125 TDs who are not Fine Gael, who can go and make a decision themselves, amongst themselves, who are calling for us to go out of government for years, who can go and sit down at a table and discuss a programme for government. And if it should arise that is impossible, and if we are asked and if we are wanted, then we will make ourselves available. But it will only be in the circumstance where all other options are exhausted. And that is what we have said consistently for 2 weeks.
In the context of today, we have our first confirmed coronavirus case. In the context of what we're hearing out of London in relation to Brexit, is it at all acceptable or appropriate that any political party would sulk in a corner and say,
"We're not sulking
we don't
in
think
a corner,
it's time
Katie.
Yet.
We've made
we don't,
our position
we don't
very
think
clear.
We don't, it's
the
not
election
time
is
yet.
Over.
Just talk to people.
So the government,
first
and foremost, the government is still in place. All of the cabinet members are still in place. All of the junior ministers are still in place.
Highly distracted, though, you would have to acknowledge.
But they're still in place and they're still working. And you can see the work, like even yesterday when I checked my email, the Oireachtas publishes what they call a documents laid, which is statutory instruments that have been
sure,
laid
over the
last
why bother forming a government at all then? No, why don't we just
well,
hang on
no,
with what
I'm
we've
saying
got?
That we have a government. We have a government.
We have a civil service.
We have Simon Coveney, who is travelling to Brussels this week. We had Leo Varadkar, who travelled to Brussels last week. I think it was Minister Creed is attending some event at a European level very shortly,
and there will be a continuity here if you're exchanging policy documents with Fianna Fáil, is it just that you need to make it as like, you know, we played as hard to get as we possibly could, but eventually ultimately they needed us, so we had to in the national interest.
Well, but we're not there yet. I mean, let's bear in mind how long
it's taken. So what, your members aren't sufficiently attuned to what must happen?
Let's bear in mind how long it took for government to be formed in 2016. And let's bear in mind that we're only 2 weeks.
Sorry, if that's now the target, I think that's
no, it's
a very
not the
worrying
target,
scenario.
But the point is that there are 125 other deputies in Leinster House who can go and talk amongst themselves.
Okay, Gary Gannon.
Yes.
You've ruled yourself out from a number of the arrangements now as well.
No, we haven't, Katie. We've ruled her out.
Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael?
Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. We haven't. That's a very important distinction. We've ruled ourselves from Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. I think we met with Fianna Fáil today. We met with Sinn Féin yesterday. We're having the day and a half session with the Greens next week. We're having a 2-day session with Sinn Féin.
So you would support a government with Fine Gael in it and Fianna Fáil in it, but just not the two together?
We are open to conversations. It's not just about supporting a government. It's about developing a programme for government. And if we felt that a programme for government had the capacity for a socially democratically led government or even influenced, we would absolutely be involved in that. One that involved Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, there is no capacity for that.
Well, what about what Harry was saying there about the, you know, if you're reading the runes from what Eamon Ryan was saying today, that it's concerns about whether Sinn Féin's figures add up, that the Greens might be edging towards the Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael.
Yeah, and I suppose I won't hold any hostility to the Greens for that. I think the Greens, I was elected on a mandate for change, and I reject the fact that anyone was elected on a mandate for opposition. I think that's abdicating a responsibility. I was elected on a mandate for change. Your transfers came across the left platform, and we stood on a platform for change. The Greens stood on a platform for urgency. They said, and they marched, they talked of 10.5 years until ecological destruction. I would probably be throwing a lot more bromides at them if you're stepping outside the government process within that. You can't say 10.5 years and step outside of 5 of them. Whereas ours, we're elected on more of an economic platform, and we need to be involved in those discussions. So we have been very responsible in terms of how we engage across the political spectrum. We didn't take ourselves off the pitch. We are not taking ourselves off the pitch. We would love to have a left-led government in this country, and we want to be involved in that process.
But you'd be prepared, perhaps, if the platform is right, to support, a Fianna Fáil-led government?
But we would be Fianna Fáil led, or would be led from the left. But if Fianna Fáil were involved in that and the programme looked okay, then yeah.
If Fianna Fáil were involved, it's not going to be led from the left.
Well, it would be if the left had the more numbers, and Fianna Fáil were just there. If there was a combination of people on the left with more numbers and Fianna Fáil were brought into that, it would be left led.
Okay. Breed.
Well, I mean, I
if that's the best you can get, the closest to a left leaning government, would
well, now
would
hang on
you
a
go?
Second. People say this election was all about change, and it certainly was. But the big message for change was to get Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael out of government. I mean, every door I knocked on, we're sick of them. We don't want them anymore. That was the response.
They still gave them 43% of the seats in the Dáil.
In working class areas in Dublin, People's Republic of South Central and all the rest of it, they did not want Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael back in. Now, I know that's an exceptional constituency, but they still, you're right, they gave them the seats that they won. But the problem with saying we will do a deal with Fianna Fáil and go into government with Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael is that you run the risk of being swamped like the Greens were, like the past, like Aon admitted himself. They have a tragic history in the Labour Party of being swamped and squashed by right-wing policies having gone into governments with Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. And I don't think, really, I think the left should have a different mindset about the outcome of this election. Change is not just all about parliamentary arithmetic. It's also about people and what they do. And if you look across Ireland today, there are at least 4 colleges occupied by students saying, we're not putting up with this. We can't afford to live in this society. We're not getting a decent education. In 2 weeks' time, we're going to have a massive climate change march, like we've had massive ones in the lead up to the election. During the election campaign, there was a national strike by teachers. There was also one of the biggest marches we've ever seen of young women calling for proper childcare. So the issues are not going to go away. And the people have to be involved in this conversation. And I love the way you asked the question at the beginning when you said, oh, Harry, what happened today? It's like you're almost drained of energy listening to this endless debate. And I believe that a lot of the tactics, particularly of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, is to bore the population to death. So in the end, we're just going to have to put up with them. They'll do a stitch up. They'll both get back in together. And when they talk about the shadowy characters behind Mary Lou and the left, when they talk about the shadowy characters behind the Ardcóiriú, they want the population to ignore the shadowy figures in the clearance house. They want the population to ignore the shadowy figures in the stock exchange and the banks who are telling them, do not let the
what you mean by the people need to be involved in the conversation. It's not just about dollar arithmetic, because actually putting together government is about the numbers. I mean,
is not just about dollar arithmetic. What the people want.
Okay.
And we've seen it in the colleges today. Now, I don't have to repeat the points I made.
I know, but I'm just wondering.
But I do think that unless we are mobilising these issues all the time, any government formation is likely to give us more of the same. Where is the radical change come from if you don't challenge the tax haven that Ireland is? If you don't take the wealth from the wealthy and begin to redistribute
like
you cannot give the change. If you don't give that change
and go after
the tax haven status that is this country, take the Apple tax back, then you're not going to be able to deliver the change that the students are screaming for, that the nurses are screaming for, that the teachers are screaming for.
Okay, I have to deliver an ad break here.
We are not giving up on the idea of a left-led minority government. We're not going to concede on that. It is possible.
I have to go to an ad break.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. And during the break, Breed Smith, just finally to finish off on this, you're saying you still haven't given up on the idea of a left-led government.
We're not giving up on a left minority government. We're not giving up. We're not conceding on that.
Would require...
We're meeting Sinn Féin tomorrow. We're going to have 2-hour conversation with them. We're meeting the Greens later on. We are looking at asking those who are elected for change to stick together and attempt to form a left minority government.
But that could, as you say, it would have to be a minority government. So that would require Fine Gael to agree to support you in a confidence and supply arrangement.
Or to butt out. They have said all along, they keep saying, Mary Lou got the popular vote, let her try and make a government. They've said it repeatedly.
But it's not that realistic as a proposition going forward.
Is it not? I mean, within a short period of time, a left minority government could actually do a lot of good for the country. We could actually reverse the pension age to 65. We could stop the sell-off of public land and give a commitment that public housing will be built on public land.
But you can't do any of this unless you get a stable government.
Can I make a quick point here?
There's left minority governments in other countries.
For all the criticism that the Labour Party gets, there wouldn't be any public land if it wasn't for the Labour Party being in government under the Troika when they wanted to sell off the whole thing. I make a bold prediction. There won't be another general election in the short term. I don't feel there will. And I'm pretty convinced at this point that it'll most likely be a Fianna Fáil Green administration with support inside or outside by Fine Gael. But I think, just to be fair to what Breed is saying, at least now we are even discussing the potential of a left-led government. 20 years ago, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and Labour were the Oireachtas. Now Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and Labour couldn't even form a government together in terms of the numbers we have. And the point I was trying to make before you cut me off earlier, was that in terms of the Labour Party, people look at the Labour Party as part of the establishment or part of the change. And the Labour Party I'd like to lead would be a Labour Party that is seen as being change.
Are you getting your posters ready for the next outing, Alan?
Well, as it so happens, tomorrow morning I'll be gathering them all into one place, cleaning them down and stacking them in just in case. That's something I do anyway. And then particularly after the 2016 campaign on the idea of going into opposition.
Do you go back around Fingal and say, let me, we made sure that we had all of our posters ready
because of course the predictions at that time were that the confidence and supply wouldn't last 6 months. So,
what about that line that was reported? I don't know, was it in your newspaper, Harry, yesterday after the Fine Gael parliamentary party, that there was mumblings from various members that Fine Gael has nothing to fear from another election?
Well, I'm not going to speak to specifics of anything that was or wasn't said, but I can say that, I mean, I don't fear another election should one arise. I'm like Aon, though. I don't think there will be another election. I think a government
so
will be
formed. So you think you will go into government
no,
with
I didn't say that. I said I think a government will be formed.
Just put the posts away dirty then, don't bother.
But my view is that, you know, you have to be prudent in any business and you have to plan ahead. And
could I make one other quick point, though, about some of the game playing? Look, I was in the Shannon for the last 4 years. I saw Fine Gael and Sinn Féin work together on the judicial appointments bill. It was only getting through stages because Sinn Féin and Fine Gael had a deal. On councils across the country.
The voting record is almost similar. Yeah. Identical in Dublin City Council.
On Dublin City Council, when Gary was there very recently, Fine Gael and Sinn Féin voted to reduce the property tax every single time.
At least they voted against a Lord Mayor that was very insulting.
I think sometimes they pretend that, you know, we have this huge ideological difference, where in councils across the country, they work... they can be bent when it suits, and it has suited
They've
for
never
you.
Been bent.
Really?
At a parliamentary level, never. Not once.
On the a judicial appointments bill, you absolutely banned them because you had a deal with them.
No.
You should deal with
them.
An unwoke metaphor, right? Marry in haste and repent at leisure. I mean, think people saying that there should be a quick solution or a quick fix to government formation, it doesn't take account of the very complex negotiations that are required, where you have parties with very different policy positions that need to have very, very detailed conversations. And what people actually want to do this time...
The parties need to commit to the actual process to begin with before we can actually go down that road.
At Spain, for example, I mean, they had four elections in Spain in very, very quick succession. And you had parties who had very radically different approaches. It's happened in Germany, it's happened in Italy, it's happening all over Europe. The model that the Greens look at is the Finnish model, where after months of negotiation, you had five different parties with very different positions that came together. It does take time to work through it. It took 74 days in 2016. I know it took a long time, but it's better for it to take a little bit longer. If you get something that's strong and something that's committed and something that's fixed.
Our 2011 document was done in a week, and that I think we should have taken an awful lot longer.
That might be the cautionary tale of our times. Just two texts before we leave this. In the last 2 weeks, Fine Gael have gone from shock to sulking arrogance. Their mantra is, we're preparing to go into opposition. Let them keep this up and they're heading into oblivion, says one. And then Sinn Féin and the left need to get over themselves. They don't have enough to form a government. People voted for change of policy. If Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil lead a government willing to change policy on health and housing, that will be change. Change doesn't necessarily mean the crazy, unaffordable policies the left are suggesting.
Well, so what took them so long? Why have they been wrecking the health service and the housing system for all the years that they've been in power? That's the first question that comes to mind. Why all of a sudden have they had a change of heart? Because they've seen the results of the election, which has moved massively to the left.
Okay, we've only a few minutes left, but I do want to ask about that developments on Brexit today and what Boris Johnson and his government are now saying. Harry McGee, they want a Canada-style trade deal, but the level playing field is...
Well, they've rejected playing field. Now, Michael Gove came in and gave a very kind of long and conciliatory speech to the Commons today, but... The language or the subliminal message coming through is unmistakable, that they're trying to revisit the withdrawal agreement and they're trying to undo a lot of the work that's been done. And Boris Johnson obviously feels emboldened by his 80-seat majority in the Commons and feels that he can go and change things. Like, for example, the border in the Irish Sea is something that now seemingly is up for discussion. And if that happens, that's going to have such a serious knock-on effect for us, because then we're going to have very hard borders between North and South.
But Alan, and we've only got a few seconds, but are we not back to where we started? We're now facing again the possibility of them walking away in June and a no-deal Brexit.
It is very problematic, Katie, and I'm glad we had a brief opportunity to raise it, because, I mean, obviously today was hugely concerning. We had a complete U-turn on positions that were already agreed, and I think Harry's absolutely right in his assessment. I mean, we should be concerned, as I think a lot of people have been for several months, that the UK government are prepared to walk away, as they suggested themselves, if they don't get some pre-agreement to an agreement that isn't going to happen. So it is a huge concern, and we may yet face this precipice at the end of December this year.
Okay. I do have to take my last break now.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And that's it. That's all we have time for tonight. I want to thank my panel for coming in to me tonight. I want to thank you all for listening. Tonight's programme was produced by Brian Lally. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon, and Andrew Kane was on sound. And now I hand you over to Carl Murray on Late Date.